This podcast was recorded on the lands of the Boon Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation, the land on which we're lucky enough to raise our sons and daughters. Always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
Hey, before we get into today's episode, just a quick reminder that if you have someone that is currently pregnant and thinking about all the things that are ahead of them, from postpartum planning to breastfeeding and returning to paid work to how on earth to navigate the childcare system and what they need to do now, we have just the guides for them. You can shop our Ready or Not go-to guides, Postpartum and Return to Work Planning, Breastfeeding and Returning to Work, and Childcare 101 for $69 as a bundle or $29 individually. They're packed full of information created with experts, and I personally think they're brilliant. You can shop them now in our show notes or readyornot.au. And I know times are tough, so here's a discount. Use Ready10 to get 10% off at the checkout. Hello and welcome to Witching Hour, the show that looks at what's exciting, delighting, intriguing and frustrating us when it comes to making work work. I'm Lou and today I have an old work friend joining me. Her name is Rana Hussain. She's a diversity and inclusion specialist. She's a pop culture fan. She's a sports fan. She's one of the smartest people I know. I had the great pleasure of working with her again recently on the Outer Sanctum podcast. Hello, Rana. Welcome to the show.
Hello. It's so good to be here. I'm honestly jumping out of my skin. I'm very, very pleased.
And I'm jumping out of my skin because, as I just said to you before we started recording, you decided to be on the Imperfects podcast just as we started recording. This will be released the day after that goes live. So thank you for bringing more eyeballs to you. How are you feeling? I imagine there's a bit of a vulnerability hangover.
Yeah, there really is. It's fine for me. And I always feel like this as a broadcaster and presenter. Like, you know, I've been in front of crowds of, you know, 80, 90,000 people at the MCG. And that doesn't bother me because it's just like an anonymous mass of people. But my phone is blowing up with people that I actually know.
Yes.
Saying, oh my God, you're on the Imperfects. And then I go, oh, yeah, you're all going to listen to that now and learn a lot about me. So that is what I think is freaking me out. So I'm definitely, I've got the vulnerability hangover. But I have to say, I'm so honoured to get the call up from the Imperfects, very out of the blue.
How did that actually come about while you're on that?
I think it was a weird, when I actually went in to record it, we sort of realized that we had so many avenues in which that could have been teed up. Like there was actually quite a Venn diagram of, you know, acquaintances and friends that we all were connected by. But it really randomly actually, I think, happened through Hugh Van Kylenberg, who hosts the podcast and heads up the Resilience Project. His partner, Penny Moody, who's an exceptional woman, has written books about mental health and OCD. She and I connected over Instagram totally separately of him or anything else. And she and I just, you know, connected over shared interests, as you do in this modern world. Like that's also a very kind of 2024 thing to say. And we had a coffee. And then I think, I can't guarantee this, but I think she said, you should probably have this person on your show. And actually it turned out I'd once been interviewed by Hugh on the ABC a couple of years ago. So it all just was a few different points, but I reckon it was Penny. Shout out to Penny Moody. He's incredible.
Shout out to Penny. I'll actually link in the show notes. I've chatted to her before and I've chatted to you before. So anyone new to the show, I think you're the sixth ever episode. Yes. And I don't know if I can go back and listen to me, but I know that you said good stuff. So I'm going to link that in the show notes. I also love these worlds colliding via cricket. So you and I worked at Cricket Australia. Hugh is a massive cricket fan from what I've sort of heard in drips and drabs. So full circle moment. Rana, totally. Before we get to a good news story, you have a business called Good Human. Tell us about that quickly.
Yeah, Good Human is something that I started not that long ago and it's sort of evolving and it's moving and changing, and which is kind of how I do things. People often ask me, you know, what's your strategy? How do you strategize? I'm really not that person. I kind of dive in and then work it out as I go and move with what I think, where I think the needs are at the moment. I think of Good Human more as a movement than a business, really. It's really helping people to develop and create and drive environments of belonging and connection. And so we do that through, you know, working with workplaces on inclusion and belonging, helping them strategize around that. We also do that through, you know, making content with other people like you and like the Imperfects, and turning up in different places and doing a lot of speaking. And we also do that through some social impact projects. So I do a lot of work with the Do More Project, which is an anti-racism project that Ben Simmons, the NBA basketballer, kicked off, and a lot of other kind of grassroots stuff. You can go and check it out. But it's really, for me, everything that I've always ever done in one place. But I'm loving at the moment being able to go into workplaces and help them understand what belonging looks like. It's kind of a dream job.
I'm actually also going to link the belonging episode that the Outer Sanctum recorded with you, because wow, there were some light bulb moments in that. And I absolutely loved being able to produce that. My only note for you with Good Human is that it should be Great Human, because you are a great human. And on that topic, bring us a great news story in lieu of Loz not being here.
Yes. Well, on Monday, the 26th of August, my good news for you all listening here is that in 2 days' time, the Paralympics is going to kick off. I'm so excited. I was at the Olympics in Paris, and it's only 2 days away that we're going to see the opening ceremony for the Paralympics, and it's all happening there. We have to give our eyeballs to these games. It's just gone from strength to strength. I can't say that today, Lou. I'm so sorry. For Australia, we have 61 debutantes, 99 returning Paralympians, and 4 Indigenous athletes amongst them. It's just my good news for the week, actually. I cannot wait.
I was in awe. When I worked on one of the road nationals for cycling, I interviewed a lot of the para cyclists, and I was in absolute awe of their skills. It was incredible, inspired. I will be watching. Thank you for that good news story, Rana. So today, what are we talking about? We are deep diving on Mrs. Doubtfire and Gilmore Girls. We're going to be a bit silly and probably a bit serious too, as we deep dive on motherhood themes and how they're presented in this show, and maybe also how we felt watching that as children versus today. You're so smart that maybe at the time you saw it for what it was, Rana. Can you confirm that with me now?
No, not at all.
Okay, great.
I love both of these shows.
Yeah, we didn't question them at the time, and now we've got some questions and some thoughts. And then at the end, Rana, I'm going to ask you both my personal questions and from our community, all about how to foster inclusion with our children and educate them in a way that is helpful, because sometimes I think especially privileged white people can get it wrong by being nervous or hesitant of how to approach fostering inclusion and well-being with our children and belonging. And I think you're going to have some good answers there. So I'll take it away. Normally I say take it away, my friend, to Loz, but my friend Rana, I will take it away with you.
Thank you, Lou.
So Mrs. Doubtfire came to the big screen, actually, in the day where you really did only see things at the movies, RIP those days, on 16th of December, 1993. Now, Rana, that had me at just under 2. How old were you at that time?
I was in grade 2, which means I was a bit older than you.
Well, you are wiser, so I'm happy that there's a reason. Let's make that the reason that you're so much wiser than me.
It was peak. Like, I was the perfect age for this movie, though. I don't know. How old are you in grade 2?
Are you about 7?
I think
about 7 turning 8. Yeah. 7 turning 8.
Yeah.
That's actually quite amazing, because maybe you saw it when it came out in the cinemas, but that speaks to how enduring that movie was, because I would have seen that at probably 5, 8, 10, 12, who knows, but I certainly didn't go to the cinemas with my mum at under 2. At least I don't think so.
Well, for me, it was a regular at sleepovers as well. Like, it was either on TV or we were hiring out from the video store, which is such a weird phrase to say now.
Take me back to going to the video store with my mate and my mum or their mum. What a time to be alive. So don't even get me started on all of the things wrong with this film when I rewatched it, probably for the first time in a good 10, 15 years the other night that I didn't notice at the time. There's some things that I think might be particularly interesting to ask you about. There's some casual racist slurs
Do you know how you felt about that at the time versus potentially rethinking or rewatching?
Oh, wouldn't have even clocked it, or would have clocked it, but thought, as all of the casual racism of the 90s, would have gone, oh, okay, that's just
the way it is.
Yeah.
Wow. That's how I thought you might respond to that, which speaks so much to how things have hopefully changed over time. Still a long way to go, but that makes me feel sad that as a young girl that you just copped remarks like that, essentially.
Well, also Robin Williams, like, who I absolutely love, but, you know, in the comedy of that era was leaning on a lot of racist stereotypes and tropes, and, you know, that's just what came with comedy of that era. So that's you kind smart. Of, I guess you are presented with the choice of do you laugh along, and that's probably the lesser of, you know, what you're faced with, or you object to it and you'd rather just be the one, you know, laughing with them.
Speaking of belonging.
Yeah, exactly.
Or sort of missing out on a lot of that comedy of that time. Is that sort of how it felt?
Yeah, because who wants to be the person that goes, oh, actually, that's not funny, or there's something a bit weird about that. But I will say, this maybe makes me a bad person. I still love this movie, Lou.
I must admit, I do too. On top of the casual racism, there's some anti-trans innuendos in there, and there's also some moments of being a bit sort of anti-sex workers. Mrs. Doubtfire refers to Miranda as a streetwalker when she's dressed up a bit sexily and looking gorgeous, and I think go out and get that outfit, girlfriend, because she looks amazing. But she's referred to as a streetwalker, and there's this interesting thing of that the ex-husband doesn't want her to go out looking sexy because, hang on a second, you shouldn't be doing that. So all of that aside, I think as a child, I probably thought of Miranda as the villain. Watching this movie back, I feel it completely different to it. So what we have is a full-time working mum who runs the entire household as well. We see this dad that I think as a young girl, I thought was a great dad because he's silly, he's present. And I think that's all we really ask for out of dads still, even today, to an extent. I think it's changing, but that's sort of the core of how we meet this family. And then Miranda Hillard has, fair enough, had enough. She wants a divorce. She leaves Daniel. And because Daniel all of a sudden realizes what he's missing out on and the way that he didn't step up, he then applies to be the nanny. Don't even get me started on all of the sort of interesting, complex feelings I have towards the care work that he now all of a sudden wants to do and is getting paid for. And he basically getting paid for, didn't see the value in it before, but all of a sudden he's getting paid to look after his own kids as Mrs. Doubtfire. And he dresses up as a woman each day and looks after his kids as a way to be close to them. What is sitting with you right now as I describe all that to you?
Three words, really, that came to mind. I was going to ask you. For me, it was men's rights activism. That I can't believe how much this is basically a movie about a men's rights activist who is so angry with his feminist wife. And it kills me because, like I said, I absolutely loved this movie as a child and I still really enjoy it. But when I watch it now, I think, oh,
it's
no.
Like poor men, these poor goofy fun dads that just want to trash the house for the mum to come home and clean. The poor guy.
Yeah. I still, as a child, there's a scene where Robin Williams wants to celebrate his son's birthday, I think. And so, you know, throws this huge party for like 12-year-olds, which, by the way, is insane.
And it looks like it's happening midweek in the middle of the day.
Yes. Where are all these other kids' parents?
And where do these farm animals come from?
Yeah, there's a petting zoo. They end up in the house. They're using like those high school party red cup. Like, it's so weird.
Dancing on the table. Like, it's almost 10 things I hate about you meets Mrs. Doubtfire.
Correct. It's just like, okay, this is clearly, you know, fantasy land for kids. And then Sally Fields, the mother, comes home to this absolute chaos, and she's worked a really hard day, brought home the cake, and then realized it's just chaos. And this is the inciting incident for them to for her to pull the plug and break up. And I just, even as a child, remember thinking, oh, no, no, that is stressful. Like, I understand you, Sally. Like, I loved Robin Williams. I was the same. I thought, what a great dad. And I want a fun dad like that. My dad was very, very sensible, fun, but, you know, was never, I had not
wasn't throwing house parties with all your mates.
No, exactly. Would never have considered wearing a cap, baseball cap backwards for starters.
Yeah, I don't think my dad was donning a baseball cap backwards either.
Let alone, you know, bringing a pony into the lounge room. But I just remember thinking, yeah, that actually feels really stressful. And one thing I love about this movie is they do the kind of conflict that kids watch between parents really well. It yes. feels so real and lived in, that relationship.
This is actually one of the main points I'm going to bring to you. My first one, because I'm going in chronological order, and I do agree with you. I think there were glimmers when I was a kid of realizing what the mum was going through, now more so, but I do think there were glimmers. For the most part, unfortunately, I think I just wanted the happy family, the caricature of the happy family. But I do agree with you that you felt that when she arrived home, she'd worked a hard day. She's got this cake that this horse eats. Like, why is there a horse in her bloody hallway? Horse eats the cake and it's absolute chaos. So after this ensues the separation, she says, I want a divorce. All of a sudden he's moving out of the house. And what really strikes me is Robin Williams says to his son, you're the man of the house now. Don't be messy. Now, when we say that the patriarchy hurts men, this to me is the perfect example of that. What are your thoughts when I say that? And also, what do you think of the meaning behind that phrase, the patriarchy hurts men?
Well, I felt it in my bones when you said it. I mean, for me, that means patriarchy, because we often think about it as it being something that women must rail against and deconstruct at the detriment of men. And it's just not true. Patriarchy is not just about women, it is about men, and it sets up men in a way as well that's also unhealthy for them, because we limit the scope of what's possible for them and who they can be. And I think that's what's most crushing for me about the system that we live in and have lived in for quite a while, is we just don't honor, you know, the full realm of masculinity for men as well, and femininity for women, and, you know, the blending of those two things, the scope of being human. And, you know, we talked about the imperfects. That's something that that podcast does really well, of showing that men are vulnerable too, that, you know, men are entitled to feelings and the full experience of being a human. And so that's what I hear when I hear him saying that, is like, I'm giving you this mantle now that's actually not really helpful for you.
Imagine the pressure of what it seems to be about a 10-year-old boy, I'm going to peg him as about 10, to then be like, you have to step up now. You maybe have to conceal your emotions and you have to really take that sort of hard, strong line.
Yeah. And be the protector. Yeah. You know, you don't get to be a child anymore, even though that's all I've ever wanted from you. Like, I've just thrown this huge, ridiculous party for you, and now I'm saying, and I'm sure it was a throwaway line, but, it, you know, nothing's accidental in a film. You know, it's there, and we take in a message from it. You're so right. I don't think I would have clocked that as a kid, but yeah.
Definitely wouldn't have. I would have been like, yep, that's what the oldest son does. He sort of takes that burden, and he is a man, and he's not going to be feeling as sad about this as I am, which is so flawed for so many reasons and shows how deep these sort of messages run through us. The next thing that really struck a chord with me was about the 15 to 20 minute mark. He's moving out of the house and he's saying goodbye to the kids. And even rewatching this, Rana, as a 32-year-old mother of two who is a real feminist, I still find myself sympathizing a little bit with Robin Williams's character, even though as an adult, I think she should be leaving him and it makes sense that she's leaving him. I still found myself thinking, oh, poor dad, he's just trying. I know it's flawed and I know it's wrong. Again, shows how deep this stuff runs. But it made me think about the way we define a good mum versus a good dad and the sets of characteristics that take up those definitions. So for me, historically, not how I paint it today, but still how I think a lot of people in today's society do, a good mum is a giver. She's in servitude. She runs a tight ship at home. Things look clean. Things look calm. She doesn't lose it at her kids. She's happy. She's calm. She's present. She cooks good food. Things are in working order. A good dad, however, is Robin Williams. He has to be fun, a little bit present, And I don't think much else is asked of him. What do you think about that? What do you think we define as a good mum versus a good dad?
I think that's so true. I think there's an element of I'm the provider, which is why Robin Williams in this movie is still sympathetic, because it's not, like you said, he's trying. He's kind of this tortured artist almost. I mean, he's a voice character, voiceover actor, and he gets fired. There's definitely a Peter Pan vibe about him, which is really interesting when we move eventually to Gilmore Girls, because that turns up in the character of Lorelai, and it's a very interesting comparison, actually. But we get this sense from Robin Williams that he's never fully grown up. And in the guise of a man and a father, that's still really endearing. We still have space for a good-hearted but kind of rascally dad. And I think that's what gets me, that just the amount of space that he's given to fail and allowed to fail in this movie compared to Sally Fields, who's just, you know, working her butt off and then still comes off as like this hard ass and annoying. And, you know, the thing that you get from Sally Fields is she's whingy and whiny. And I think motherhood is so often, you know, wifedom and motherhood is so often framed in this era of Hollywood and television as whingy and whiny and naggy. Like that's
100%.
Oh, it kills me. But I'm the same. Him saying goodbye to his family will never not leave me in tears. Because, you know, I wonder though, don't you think both things can be true? Like that, there's a truth in that. A father, you know, having to leave. Again, if you think about the context, this was very much, you know, post-80s feminism, women in the workplace, kind of stepping into that space. I think this is actually a Hollywood version of a man's response to that.
Yeah, and it probably is actually a pretty real depiction when I think about it of the human experience a lot in that sort of dynamic. Like that is probably how it happens a lot of the time when a woman is leaving the man.
Totally. And though all of those feelings are fine and normal, it's where do we place blame, I guess. And in this movie, there's so much of it is placed on Sally Fields' shoulders unfairly, I think.
Yeah. I actually noticed yesterday that I was in a really bad mood, and I am luckily in a relationship where outside of the sort of breastfeeding, giving birth and all of that stuff, I do think we have about as fair a partnership as we can. I do notice during the parental leave time, so when the babies are really little, probably a little bit more of the mental load does fall again on me because I'm at home. But then when we sort of got out of that with Ray, it very much became 50-50. I do feel a little bit back to that just because Posey's breastfeeding and she's literally with me full time. And yesterday I was in a really bad mood and I had to eventually articulate to Hayden the fact that I haven't had any space away from babies and whatnot. And yes, you are doing a good job. You're doing the best thing you can. I know you haven't just been sitting around, but still the weight of just breastfeeding and have a baby on you all the time is a lot. Do you find that you can still come across as the naggy mum, even though, as you and I know, that's not what we are?
A really bad example for this, because I reckon, if I'm honest, and probably why this movie resonates with me, is that I reckon I'm a bit of a Robin Williams in my relationship.
That's why you have so much sympathy for him.
Yeah, I really relate. I'm the failing white man in my relationship. My partner, I'm so blessed. My partner does a lot of the mental load and heavy lifting, and a lot of that is circumstantial because he's a teacher. My daughter works at goes to the school that he teaches at, and so they're together all the time. He's taking her to school and bringing her home. He's at the school, so he's getting all the information. Like he's translating everything from school to home. I'm working, and I work weird hours, evenings as well, because there's always an event to MC or whatever it is. So I often feel like I'm not carrying enough mental load. And as a woman, a lot of people assume that I am.
Yeah. Do you think you wear that guilt different to your partner would if it was the reverse?
Very much so. Because similar to you, when my daughter was very little, you know, the first year of her life, it was all me. It was breastfeeding. It was, I was on maternity leave and I did everything and was happy to do it, but definitely had those moments of like, all right, come on, mate,
yeah.
Step in. And then it just flipped. And as a woman, as a feminist, knowing what I know, I'm so attuned to how quickly you can let it go and let the other person take up more and more of the load. And I find myself really having to have talks to myself about like, don't be that bloke. Like, don't be that bloke in a relationship. No, like, to take it on. Like, I find myself saying things like, oh, but I don't know how to do that. Like, you're the one who's done it. Or you, like, you take her to swimming all the time. And my partner will be like, yeah, but you can take it.
Yeah,
you know?
That's a really, you bring up an interesting question that I've always wanted to ask people when I get off chats, but never sort of think to in the time. And also because I'm a bit nervous of how to word this, because I think I'm in a real feminist relationship where, as I say, like, he does a lot of the cooking and cleaning and stuff. And yes, I feel like a bit of that touched outness falls on me in the first year and those little things. But outside of that, things are feeling pretty good and pretty even. A few of my guests on the Ready or Not interviews have mentioned feeling more that other way. And in a lot of ways, I'm cheering. I'm like, how good's that? The dad's carrying more of the mental load. But then if I sort of really criticize my feminism, I think, well, is that quite fair? How does that sit with you?
Oh, so uncomfortably. Like, I'm very much in the camp of my feminism and my understanding of equity and equality and fairness and how a good relationship should work should mean that I step up and we share it. And it doesn't need to be, you know, one for one, you know, you did this, so I do that, you know, but making sure that everybody's comfortable with the load that they're carrying and checking in and doing all of that. And actually, it has to be on me to make sure that conversation's happening, because he is just carrying all the load. Like, he can't then also be the one to say, I'm struggling, and like, I need to actually be really live to that if I'm not the one who's naturally gravitating to the domestic stuff. So, you know, it's actually quite alarming to understand how easy it is to sit back and let it happen. And then, you know, for me, building a business, trying to carve out this career, you know, I can lean on, yeah, but I'm trying to do this for the family and I'm trying to do that for the family. And it takes vigilance. And I really believe that as feminists, if we've pushed for men to take up the load, we have to also be vigilant that if we're tipping over into the other side, that we're just not that shitty partner, basically. And that's not to say that it doesn't look different in every couple. I think the key, what I've learned, is it's the communication, you know, being able to be really honest and say, where is it too much? How is it too much? And where can I help?
And then at the reverse, as I'm thinking about that, I am also thinking we almost do need to see examples of men taking on more of the load, though, to achieve more equity in a relationship. So okay. Do you think that does ring true? Even if you are feeling a bit guilty and like he's carrying a bit too much, we sort of need examples of that to then show that there can be an evenness.
Totally. And I think, you know, a place where I've really seen it, and you mentioned that we've both worked in sport together, is in the sports sector. There are so many amazing women in both administration but also on field or track or in the pool who are the ones who are really career driven. And when, you know, with a young child, I'd get really pervy with people that I worked with and say, okay, how do you do it? Like, what does it look like? What is the balance? And often for the women that I've worked with who are really kind of high up executives, their partners are carrying the load and it's okay. And so it's more around that works for their family in that moment, in that particular time, or, you know, they have nannies and stuff, but they're very honest about the fact that it's a village that's keeping it all together. It's not just one or two people. And so it was really helpful for me to have those examples. And I don't think there's anything wrong with one person taking the lead and another person taking the lead in, you know, a different realm. But it's more around, is everyone okay with that?
Yeah, it's more the communication and respect, because another thought that just came to me, a million thoughts always come to me when I'm with you, Rana, is that when we see men stepping in to that role, in a way, I think it okays it for feminist women to say, no, I'm actually okay and comfortable with being a stay-at-home mum, for example. That doesn't make me a bad feminist, as long as the partner appreciates it and communicates with you and takes off the burden where you need it, then that's okay too, as long as there's respect, right?
Yes, exactly. And it's just hit me as you said that what you hear really successful in the workplace women say always, they always acknowledge either the village or the help that they have that allows them to get to where they've gotten to career-wise. And what I would love to hear more is, yes, those stories of men doing kind of the more of the domestic leadership at home. But I want to also hear the really successful career men say, I'm really here because I have people at home and I have a person at home who is managing everything and she's working really hard. Like, I would love for them to value that role too.
Yes, that's like this reel we put up that Ryan Gosling, he was accepting some big award, I don't know which one, and he was saying how it's only possible because Eva Mendes, that's his partner, right? I'm not getting confused with celebrities.
Yeah, I'm so jealous of her, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm jealous of both of them, I almost want to say. What a relationship. He acknowledged that he could only do what he was doing, having these lovely experiences, winning these awards because she was at home. And we posted that reel. And honestly, it was annoying how much it went off because it did nothing for Ready or Not as a podcast. It had nothing to do with us. And I think it got like a million views. And Loz and I were just, I was like, I want to delete this. It's annoying me. But the message was beautiful. Let's take it back to Mrs. Doubtfire. It's just amazing, by the way, how much they take you off on tangents of life. Like, you forget why these things are important to us, why we watch movies and shows.
This is why, you know, I often say it as a joke, but pop culture is actually, I think, has been the best education for me. It's always been the way I've filtered through and it's helped me understand what I actually think about life, and sometimes in unhelpful ways, but as I get older, I've been able to really unpack that. So everything relates back to a movie or a TV show for me.
Everything does for me too. And I really thank people like Shameless for perhaps making us able to talk about things like this, because I think it's only really become an accepted form of dissecting serious topics via silly mediums. My next one for you, Rana, and this one makes me a bit angry, makes me the angry mum that is portrayed in this movie, is that Robin Williams has the three kids over in his decrepit apartment one night. He's having them for dinner and he asks the kids how the battle axe is going. Now, I had never heard of the term the battle axe, which maybe is a bit naive of me, maybe a bit embarrassing to admit, but it stuck with me, so I had to Google it. A battle axe is a derogatory traditional stereotype describing a woman characterized as aggressive, overbearing and forceful. So as we say, the way a lot of mums and a lot of women are painted, what further got me going about this is that firstly, obviously just ew, I'm so bored and sick of that stereotype. But secondly, there's a few times where he talks about Miranda to his kids or puts her in an uncomfortable spot in front of the kids. And we see a double standard further on when he is portraying Mrs. Doubtfire, dressed up as Mrs. Doubtfire. And he tells Miranda, after she makes a little bit of a joke about him in front of the kids, that she shouldn't speak that way about the father of her children in front of said children, which I do agree with. I think Hayden could do terrible things to me. And depending on the level of terribleness, I would still probably want to paint him in a really good light for his kids, which I think is a fair and valid point. But there's incredible double standard there. She talks about looking for a housekeeper for $300 a week, and all of a sudden we find him offering to do that very stuff that he never did. And he begs in front of the kids. The kids then beg the mum and she says she'll think about it. And then we have this moment of him pulling her up, being like, don't speak about him in front of the kids in that way. What does that tell you about double standards and, again, about this sort of way that society is happy to perhaps paint the mum as angry, but we're not very happy to pull up the dad?
Well, again, for me, it is about the role of the father and that being the primary, like that being the nexus of the nuclear family. And so we have to protect him and his role at all costs. And the loss, what this movie really does pull on for me is the disintegration of the American nuclear family as we know it and the perils of that and how tragic that can be and what that means for society. And there's an argument to say that it's also pushing against that, particularly when you think about the ending, which I assume we'll get to. Yes. But that particular moment, what you're talking to there for me is really about that. Like the family can collapse, but the role of the father and the patriarch and, you know, the patriarchal power in society, I feel a bit like I'm very first year creative arts film and feminist theory here. I apologize. That's all, you know, my brain can't help but go there. That's all I hear when I hear that. And just that's the vibe for me. You know, how dare we, how could we ever deign to malign this father figure?
Oh, that's very well said. And I love it when you go there. So keep going there. I have two more points for you. I realize that we're going off on all these tangents and I'm probably keeping you for longer than intended. The next one is during a heart-to-heart between Mrs. Doubtfire and Miranda. Mrs. Doubtfire says a flawed husband is better than none at all. Oh. In that moment, I really think of her as the old lady character that she's playing rather than, I mean, I know that throughout this, it's Robin Williams pushing to get back with his family. But in that moment, I more see her as playing that older mentor role to a younger mum. Mm. And it reminds me of the amount of mums and women who would have stayed in relationships that didn't serve them because of this very logic or because they wanted babies perhaps and were too scared to start again at whatever age they thought it was too old to go back to the drawing board. Do you think this is changing yet, or do you still think that society is sort of believing that messaging of a shit husband is better than no husband at all, basically?
I think it's changed for some of us. I think feminism is working for groups of women
that are open to it.
Yeah, and largely privileged women. Like I think that being able to say, yeah, I'm going to go it alone, I'm going to do it alone, is really only a viable option for wealthy women.
That is such a good point that you raise, because I was even just thinking about their divorce in the context of my life, and it would be possible for me. I'm privileged. I don't want to, but I was just, you know, you start to play these things out in your head and like, how on earth would you do that? But it got me to thinking about all the finances and potentially people leaving dangerous relationships, all of the emotional load there. It would be so hard if you're not in a privileged position.
Yeah, like if we only think about the economics of it, let alone the social and emotional and relational community stuff, friends and family, just the economics of it, you know, I think the stats show that divorce ends up being harder for women economically. So this story is also quite an anomaly in that way too, because we are looking at quite a wealthy woman who can afford to divorce, and actually he's the one that's going to struggle economically, which again makes him in the film a more sympathetic character. So we do, because otherwise if he was a wealthy guy and he acted like that, we would all be like, yeah, get rid of him. Like, you know, we wouldn't care about him. We'd be like, yeah, shack up with Pierce Brosnan. Like, that makes sense.
It does make sense visually.
It sure does. But because he's also just hard done by, he's just been fired, like, as a character, it makes us more sympathetic towards him. But in reality, that's just not how it statistically works anyway. And so, you know, I think when women do lean on that, like it's, well, it's just better to stick with someone, there is a kind of pragmatic reality to that. Putting that aside, though, I think we actually have evolved away from that ideologically, at least. I think a lot of women, like I was at a cafe the other day, sorry, this is such a tangent, but I was listening to two Gen Zs, like older Gen Zs, have a conversation about, and the woman was saying, like, I think I'm just going to have a baby on my own. And like they were genuinely just having a conversation about that, as if that was the most kind of common thing. There was no stigma around it. There was a conversation about love and relationships, but also I want a child. And so I think that's probably going to be my path. And here's how I'm thinking. And I just thought, wow, yeah, we really.
Yeah, that's so liberating.
It really was. And I think, like, when I heard that, when I think about Mrs. Doubtfire saying that, like, all I can think about is my mother and my grandmother saying very similar things. And also me internalizing that, like, when I've had breakups, thinking, am I going to be alone? Like, maybe I'd rather just stay in this shitty relationship than actually be by myself. And like now I'm like, God, being by myself sounds amazing.
Yeah, some alone time would be gorgeous. I would love to be trapped for some alone time. Just but put me did. On a long haul flight. Oh, you just did that. That must have been.
It was genuinely amazing. If any woman can afford it and do it, I mean, I could barely afford it, but I was very thrilled to be on a 10-hour flight by myself. It was genuinely a thrill. I will say, though, the whole tradwife era that we're in and this kind of, there is a real backlash towards feminist ideals, I think, in the Gen Z population, parts of the Gen Z population around actually having a husband is everything and being a mother is everything.
Yeah.
So I do wonder if we've kind of veered away, but we're also coming back to those notions too.
I want to pull myself up on something. If I was listening to two males on a podcast and one of them mentioned the looks of the female, like I just did, I wouldn't feel very good about that. Where do you think that, yeah, like I think that I'm allowed to because I'm a woman and men don't get as sexualized as we do. How do you feel about that? Because I said Pierce Brosnan, you know, visually looks good and it visually is a good choice. Whereas if a man said that, I'd be a bit like, ew.
You know what I mean? So I piled on too. It's a good question. I think you're probably right. I think the difference for me is I don't mind if a man acknowledges a beautiful woman. I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe I don't, if it's not in a sexual or it's dangerous way, perhaps I don't either, actually, to be honest, if it's just a nice little comment. Is that where you're getting it?
I think so. That's my metric for it. And also I heard that as a comment about both Sally Field and Pierce Brosnan being very attractive people.
Yeah, they are.
But no, that's another podcast.
Yeah, we'll have to think more about that one. Okay, I have two more things for you, Rana. One quick one is a plot line that I actually almost wish was given more airtime. I don't think it would have made the film better. I just think it would have been an interesting thing for you and I to chat about. And that is Mrs. Doubtfire getting on the bus to go home, gets a little bit of the sexy eye from the bus driver, feels uncomfortable about it. And I find it fascinating because I feel like men often perhaps don't understand the unsafe feeling we get until they step in to a female person. Did you notice that?
Totally. And I remember, I think about it actually, I've thought about it a few times just randomly because like what I feel in that moment is also a bit of envy that he's a man identifying as a man in drag and so has the kind of confidence and physical capability to defend himself in that moment too.
Oh, that's a fascinating point. So even if he's feeling a bit vulnerable, it's still really not the same vulnerability that we'd feel.
No. And I think I just noticed my own like, oh yeah, he can snap back to being a man in that moment and say, rack off. And I'm like jealous of that ability because I don't have that in me usually. Some women do, I don't. If I'm leered at or hit on, that's not how I would deal with that because I'm genuinely thinking, well, if I do that, how does that make me more unsafe? So I'm more likely to reach for gentle kind of dismissal and nice packaging of, okay, I'm just going to move over here now and get safe. So that's what comes at me in that moment. But then it also does make me think about the violence that trans women experience, which is a very separate thing. And again, he's not a trans woman, so he can just kind of reach out to a male masculine identity for that strength and whatever he needs to be safe again. So yeah, that's all the stuff that comes up for me watching that.
Oh, wow. You've just brought up some incredible points. Again, this is probably a whole nother podcast. We could have 10 off spins of this exact episode. Now let's go to the ending, which we've touched on. For me, there's something quietly radical about the ending of this movie because I think the Lucy of first watching, let's say I was 7, would have wanted this couple to get back together, for there to be a happy family, happy, 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 everyone's happy, man and wife together, ending is great. But what happens instead is Mrs. Doubtfire now has her own TV show, which is a nice sort of way to see that maybe Daniel is becoming a grown-up, he's becoming responsible and also fulfilling his creative passions that might make him a more happy, well-rounded person. He gets a letter written into him, or Mrs. Doubtfire does, where a little child writes in saying that their parents have split up and they're wondering if they're a proper family anymore. And we hear a quite lovely ending by Mrs. Doubtfire over the top of some beautiful footage of, I think, him leaving the house with the kids. I think he's picking them up in the footage. And Mrs. Doubtfire is talking about the fact that there's all different types of families and they're all basically legitimate and they're all valid, and that it basically a family doesn't have to be man and wife, three gorgeous kids, and that's it. I found this quite amazing because I think, especially in those days, but potentially still now, we often want to see the parents stay together for better or worse. As a mum, I now don't think that. As we've touched on, there's a lot of, I guess, economic reasons why it can be really tricky, and there's a lot to work through if someone is divorcing that makes it really sad. And divorce still can be sad. There's still some really hard elements that make us perhaps always a bit sad about these things. But I think it's quite great that the producers and the writers of this show kept them separate. They're these fully actualized people that you can tell are going to have quite nice lives separately, and they're going to sort of figure it out. How did you feel about the ending?
I fully agree. I think it's quite radical. And I think is the thing that saves the movie for me, and actually is the thing that means there's a reading of this movie that is less about the crumble of the nuclear family and a kind of rage against that, but more a grappling with the idea of, okay, we now live in this era. Again, you know, this is early 90s, so off the back of kind of great economy, but also hyperfeminism and divorce being kind of at its peak for America. A reading of like, okay, we're in this place now. This is how we're going to move forward. Like, it is just kind of a meditation on the breakdown of the nuclear family, but not in necessarily a completely negative way. And the idea that men are going to now be in the world in different versions and different guises. And, you know, in this film, it's literally, you know, he's Mrs. Doubtfire, but Mrs. Doubtfire gives him a way to connect with his children in a really vulnerable way, in a much more kind of nurturing way than he ever had before. And it sort of opens up that realm for him as a man in this new era. And so for me, you know, that's a more hopeful read of this movie. And I feel like the ending really actually lands us in that place and gives us that opportunity to say that offering of family is going to look and sound and feel really different. And that's okay, as long as you've got kind of the nurturing and the love, and everybody's comfortable with how it is. And I think, like I said, for me, it saves the movie.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. There's something so beautiful about it. And I imagine kids across the world grappling with their parents splitting up, and what like a warm cup of comfort that sort of ending must have been, because so many of us would have been rooting for them to get back together. Old me isn't, but I would have 100% back in the day. And I thought, wow, you really won me back, and I'll probably watch it again because of that reason. Rana, I have waffled. Let's take it to Gilmore Girls. You brought up something incredibly interesting, and that's the parallel of these two different parents from two different shows that sort of are portrayed like they didn't grow up. The first being Daniel, and we think we give him a lot more, I guess, space to not grow up. And then we have Lorelai, who I feel like is given no space at all. Talk to me about this.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Gilmore Girls, if you don't know, and I mean, I'll be really shocked if you don't.
And a bit annoyed.
Yeah, frankly, quite annoyed. Gilmore Girls is based on the story of Lorelai and Rory Gilmore, who are a mother and daughter duo. Lorelai had Rory when she was 16. She comes from a very kind of wealthy Connecticut family and then got pregnant. Teen pregnancy was such a big deal in the 90s. Apparently. I feel like it was the only thing that could go wrong for a girl. That's all I ever heard about, was just don't get pregnant.
Yes, so true.
And so this delves into that. But, you know, the show starts when Lorelai's 30 and Rory's 16. And they have this beautiful relationship where they're more best friends than they are mother and daughter. And that's sort of where we, how we start with them. And Lorelai really, you know, especially in the early seasons, the roles are really flipped. Rory is this very sensible, studious young woman who's really got a good head on her shoulders. She's not the kind of quintessential 90s, 2000s teens who's drinking and, you know, experimenting with boys. She's very kind of grounded and bookish, which is why I loved her, because she's felt way more like me and my friend than any other depiction of adolescence at the time. Lorelai is depicted as a teen who was meant to be kind of a bit more wild when she was 16, does get pregnant, and is still kind of in that Peter Pan space where she hasn't quite evolved out of some of her love of pop culture and silliness. And so, you know, you get the sense of this 16-year-old raising this child and really leaning on kind of music and pop culture and film of the era. And she is, you know, there's so often times where you're thinking you're the mum and you're making some really poor decisions. You know, I think for the audience, she comes across as pretty endearing. She's an absolute favourite for anybody who watches it. But as you continue to watch it, she becomes, there's a way of reading this that is, that she's quite irritating, that there's something annoying about Lorelai. And there are moments for sure where you think, okay, just grow up, mate. Yes. It's time to grow up now. And that kills me because I really relate to Lorelai.
I love Lorelai.
She's, you know, what she embodies, I think, for a lot of women is that sense that you can be a mother and you don't need to lose yourself. You don't need to lose your spark, your joy. She's such a joyous character. She's very silly. And, you know, it is that move away from a nagging mother to a fun mum. She gets to be the fun mum. And I think I hadn't really seen that at that time.
You had me ask the community what they thought about whether Lorelai was a good mum or not. My immediate response was yes, because she makes Rory feel held and safe. She talks to her like she's a person, not like a kid. I absolutely agree that she is deeply flawed, which I feel like a lot of people sort of take that on as well, even if they do love Lorelai. And I think she's not afraid to show it to Rory. What's your take on her as a mother?
I think all of that's true. I think, and I will caveat this with, I am like, I don't know anything as well as I know Gilmore Girls. So I cannot tell you the amount of hours I've spent either listening to podcasts about it or watching it or thinking about it. So this is very deep in the weeds. And I will have, like, Gilmore Girls is just on in my house all the time.
Like, yes, it's like your background watch. Mine's Sex and the City, which I feel like yours is a bit better than mine. I'm a bit trashy.
No, it's not. And Sex and the City gets a play as well. Like, I did my whole master's degree with Gilmore Girls on in the background. Like, that's how I get through anything I have to do. But Sex and the City also gets a play. I just have to have something in between because, like, I can run Gilmore Girls back to back. Like, I can go back to season one and start all over again. Sex and the City, I need a little bit of a break. And
yeah, Carrie's a bit more annoying than Lorelai.
What a line, but yeah. So Lorelai, for me, I think the thing that gets me, and Lorelai's mother, Emily, this whole show is a meditation on motherhood and what that looks like. And there are so many versions of mothers in this, which is, I think, why I love it so much. And yeah, they're deeply problematic. There's also a real conversation about class in it too. And there are no black or brown people in the show.
Yes.
So it's a weird moment in time of pop culture. But her mother, Emily, is also an incredible kind of version of motherhood that is very loving but deeply flawed. And what I see in both of them is the potential for their love to be conditional. So for Lorelai, you feel yourself, and in the later seasons this gets unpacked, you see her and Rory have real conflict when Rory starts to act in ways that Lorelai doesn't really approve of, when she wants to, you know, leave college, and when she makes decisions about some partners, and the first time Rory has sex, you start to see that kind of bestie, you know, veneer crumble. And I do wonder that you see Lorelai even like step away from a relationship with Rory, which seems so mind-boggling. And it's often around, you didn't do the thing I wanted you to do.
Which sort of flies in the face of what you think Lorelai to be like as a mum, because I'm thinking more the early seasons where it's sort of like acceptance and yes, you're amazing, but you're so right. It sort of changes. Everything turns on its head.
And I love that because we're all going to go through that as parents when our kids do things we don't think that they should do. And it's not just, oh, you know, you stayed out too late. It's, you know, when they make major life decisions that we're not comfortable with, it does really make me think, how am I going to deal with that? And will I do a Lorelei and cut my child out of my life for a period of time? Or will I still turn up? And I've gone over that so much in my head about her decision-making as a parent, because I think in those moments she's acting as the best friend. And I think, I wonder as a mother, would I do that? Is my role as a mother to voice my concern and disapproval but still be there?
Yeah. I was listening to a podcast today because I had to get back in the headspace of Gilmore Girls, even though I binged the whole thing through COVID. I have the memory of a fish. And there was a really interesting piece on this podcast called Gilmore to Say, and a listener voice memoed in questioning whether Lorelei was the villain. So they're talking about the different villains in this show. And this person had a really interesting point, which I agreed with the host that I had myself sort of feeling a bit at odds with at the start, but then I understood her point of view. So she starts by saying that Lorelei sort of encourages and embraces everything that Rory does in the early days. But as soon as Rory perhaps starts to embrace the wealth of her grandparents and the aspirational qualities of high-level education and all of that stuff that Lorelei was sort of helping her do. Like, she wanted her to go to Yale, didn't she? Would you say that that's true?
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah, like, yeah. She really fostered that. And then I think when Rory started to step more into that elitist mindset, she really backtracked and couldn't quite grapple with it. And this person was then saying that when she became a mum, she found it really hard then seeing Lorelei almost cut Rory off and like not speak to her, and how childish that seemed. I'm interested to know how you feel about all of that.
Yeah, I feel very similarly. Like I said, I think that was probably the moment where I thought, like, even early days when Lorelei is immature and manages her parenthood in kind of odd ways, A, super relate to that, and B, find that fine. Because I think as parents, you just have to find your own way through. And I really reject a lot of what comes at us these days in particular about this is a good parent and that's not a good parent. You know, I really find that challenging. So, you know, I often think to myself, well, you know, if going to Brunetti's and having a cannoli with my daughter is the way I want to bond with her, I think that's fine.
Oh, can I be your daughter? Can I come?
Please join us. But when Lorelei does really disconnect from Rory, I do question a little bit. And I don't know if that's fair either, because that's more me saying that's not what I think motherhood is about. I don't know that, you know, or at what point do you disconnect with your child? And being frustrated with who Rory, what I read into that is she's really frustrated with who Rory becomes, and she's not entirely approving of that, to which I think you raise this kid. You know, there's not a lot of self-awareness around, I'm a huge part of this, yes. Of who Rory becomes. I actually don't think Lorelei's the villain. I do actually, by after all my rewatches, actually land in Rory might be the villain.
That's interesting. Unpack that.
I think she's lawful evil. Dungeons and Dragons fans will know what that means. As she gets older, like you said, like the question says, she really becomes a very entitled, privileged, unself-aware young woman, and is really kind of very comfortable with taking other people's money, having expectations of life, that she is entitled to jobs, to winning all the time, to making it. And she's been raised with that. She's been told her whole life that she's exceptional, that she's special, that she is the most amazing person in that town of Stars Hollow of about 50 people. I mean, there are other kids that go to school there, but no one cares about them.
No, it's all Rory.
All Rory. So she's just, of course, that's who she was going to become. It doesn't surprise me, but I think she's the one that kind of, in the end, her arc is one that starts really like in a beautiful place and unravels in my mind. Whereas I think Lorelei largely stays the same, evolves a little bit, but has to just kind of suffer through the consequences of her choices and her parenting, but also the parenting she receives. So for me, she's not quite the villain, but I do think there's not a lot of awareness from Lorelai to understand what her parenting choices actually did lead to as well.
Yeah, this podcast also raised a really interesting point that there's a sort of theory that you stop growing up when your first baby is born. And I think that's a really interesting exploration when you think about Lorelai as a character. I have one more question for you. Even though she drives me mad, even though I think she's a classist bitch, why do I still sympathize with Emily?
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I love Emily.
Why?
And the older I get, the more I love her. I know. I mean, there really is a dynamic that's very my mother and me, Emily and Lorelai. So there's also a lot of projection onto those two characters for me. I love Emily because she is motivated by love. She's also motivated by expectation and duty. And I think all these characters are just products of their own environments, right? So I think at the end of the day, that's where I land. I have grace for all of them. Emily deeply loves her daughter and her child and only wants the best for her. And that comes out because of her context in really controlling ways. She is villainous. I mean, some of the stuff she does is just diabolical. But I think it's that she's a very scarred woman herself. And so I think as a mother, I really am understanding now that everybody's just doing the best they can with what they were given.
It's a really interesting piece about that whatever you'll sort of emerge from through your childhood and as you're growing up in the world, it informs you so much. So it is an important reminder, I guess, to hold grace for those things, even if it eventuates or realizes itself or actualizes itself in habits, behaviors, and language that you think is unacceptable.
And I think, you know, I often see now on TikTok those, you know, reels around what does breaking the cycle look like. So if you've inherited trauma, and I'm not saying that the Gilmores have trauma, although maybe they do, you know, what does it mean to actively break the cycle for your child? And I think that is what Lorelai was trying to do in running away and raising her child in Stars Hollow away from all of that privilege. And so that's why I think Rory, there's just such a melancholy kind of end to that arc because she sort of lands back there anyway.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I'll take it to the polls now, Rana, because I don't want to just keep you forever. I mean, I do actually. I want to keep you forever.
Loving it.
But I'm aware that you're a busy person. First poll question for you that I asked our Ready or Not community on Instagram is, if you watched Mrs. Doubtfire as a kid, did you feel sorry for Robin Williams' character, Daniel Hillard, and less sympathetic towards Miranda Hillard? What percentage of people do you think said yes?
Was it if they watched it as a kid?
Yes. Yeah, so this is the lens of your childhood you. Oh. And did you feel sorry for him?
I reckon like 60% would have said, yeah, they felt sorry for him.
95%.
Yeah. Yeah.
So everyone, at least we're in the majority in a very big way.
Yes.
My next question here, which was similar, but I don't really know what I was getting at. I think I just wanted to know where people landed on all of the different contexts of that movie and all the different moving parts. As we've discussed, there's things that we feel differently about, and we still hold space for Daniel in a few ways, but for the most part, we think he needs to really grow up. So I think this is what I was getting at in this question, which is, do you think overall you feel differently about the movie than when you first watched it? So there were three options: definitely, sort of, and no. What percentage do you think was definitely?
I reckon, all right, I'm going to say like 70% feel differently.
63%, so pretty close. So then 27% said sort of. So I reckon they're the people that, like you and I, felt sorry for her when she walked into the party. So they had moments probably of understanding at the time, but now more so. And no, 10%. I'm hoping those people are, because that was just unbelievably actualized 10-year-olds and they got it then and there, as opposed to being like, no, stuff, Miranda. And then to the Gilmore Girls part, what percentage of people do you think said Lorelai is a good mother?
Oh, I reckon I'm going to say 50. I reckon that one would have gone down the line.
89%.
Wow. So
a lot of people agree with us that, while deeply flawed, Yeah. She's a good mum, which I think because of the age bracket of people that follow Ready or Not probably gives us a more concentrated answer. I think if you had a broad spectrum, if we put 200 women of different ages in the room and then asked them, I reckon it would be more what you were saying. So I was quite surprised by that too.
There are people, that's why.
Yeah, exactly. So Rana, to end, because you're a specialist in this space, I asked our community if they had any questions about how to foster diversity and inclusion with their children and also promote, I guess, healthy discussion around this topic. My first question comes from me because I'm selfish, and that is that Rye, where I live, is not the most multicultural place, unfortunately, and I really notice it, and a lot of my friends really do too. So I want to know from you, when I'm dropping Ray off to daycare and there's really only about two kids in his class that are not white, how do I foster a sense of how do I promote a sense of diversity and inclusion within him when there's not a hell of a lot of examples in our really local community?
It's really hard. If there isn't a kind of thriving diversity in your community, it's hard because the answer really is to model it like everything else. It's if they see you doing it, they'll do it too, and they'll kind of absorb that. So that's really hard when you don't necessarily have a lot of opportunities, but still making the effort to be friends or friendly, or, you know, say hello to their parent, that those children's parents, and teach them. Notice if your child has a bit of that, like, oh, that person's different, so I'm staying away. A lot of the time we say to ourselves, oh, children don't think like that. They really do. They notice difference straight away, actually. And so sometimes that doesn't bother them, sometimes it does. And so I think also as parents, we've got to notice that. I had that with my daughter, who is a mixed race child. At her childcare, there was a child from the Horn of Africa with really, really dark skin. And I noticed she was challenged by that. And so instead of kind of just clocking it and letting it play out, I really made sure that I was having conversations with her about that. I modeled being, you know, respectful and encouraging connection with that child, not forcing it on her because that can also be really odd and weird, but just making sure that I showed and signaled to my daughter that this is okay. You can say hello to someone that is different to you. And, you know, it might come in the guise of disability, it might come in the guise of an accent or just difference, neurodiversity. How do you keep modeling that? I think if you don't have different types of people in your circle, then I think you do a scan of your cultural diet. So what television are you watching? What podcasts are you listening to? What accents are in your life? You know, even as simple as that, how can you infuse that in their world and your own?
We have a lot of Indigenous books too, actually. So I think books is a good one with kids.
Amazing. Absolutely. And then as they get older, allowing the conversation to expand. So, you know, just asking a simple question or delving a little bit deeper so that then they're not just kind of consuming it and forgetting about it. It's landing and settling in them too. So I think all of those are the really simple ways. And I think we all do that anyway. You know, we're all buying books constantly and trying to read to our kids. So just diversifying what narratives they get. The other one that I often underestimated and do underestimate with little kids is challenging narratives. So when they come to you with a particular narrative, whether it's around gender or something else, or you notice it in the world, pulling it up and having a little teaching moment, it's just like everything else. It just takes effort and a bit of foresight. But when it comes from mum and dad or mum and mum or dad and dad, it's going to be so much more impactful. And it's just, how do I infuse it? Like, you know, you hide veggies in their food.
Yes.
how do I infuse this and get different kind of messaging? And really, I think at that age, what we're doing is normalizing the idea of diversity.
It's interesting what you bring up with your daughter, because I'm really ashamed now to say that I remember starting prep and being a bit scared of someone that looked really different. They had an afro and they had dark skin. And I am embarrassed even to admit that now, but I remember being scared, which is just so messed up to think now, because it was something different. I don't know. And I remember my mum just sort of sitting with me and being like, no, that's okay. You can talk to her. And this is just Yeah. This is a normal part of life and you're starting to get a bigger understanding of the world. So I think that's so important.
Well, you fear that fear, you know, this is what we talk about when we talk about unconscious bias, and that comes from the messages that we get from our environment. And I know for me personally, that came in the form of like all the Disney movies I watched. You know, we're talking about pop culture. For me, it was pop culture from a very early age that taught me what was beautiful, what was scary. Think about even things like Scary Spice.
That is actually, do you know what? I was just about to say that's a perfect example of probably what informed that bias within me as a bloody four and a half year old starting school.
And I think, you know, the key there, because we can then internalize that shame later on in life when people come at us with that kind of punitive approach. So for our children, it's unpacking it for them before that and really rewiring that messaging that they get, which is so hard because they're getting it on a number of different levels.
Yeah.
But really, I guess the message is difference is okay. There's nothing to be scared about. And, you know, teaching them how to say hello to people, waving and smiling and saying hello when they're comfortable to do it, is actually really great micro, like belonging micro cue for other people. Yeah. Just a smile, an eye contact and a hello, a greeting that's respectful, teaches them how to do that, but also helps other people feel welcomed.
Okay, we have 5 more minutes. I have 2 more questions. The first is for older kids that might come really openly and say out loud in front of another child to their parent, why does that kid have dark skin? Why is that kid in a wheelchair? I could give you a million examples. How do you think you best combat that with, say, a 7-year-old, 10-year-old who are really open and honest? And it can be probably quite confronting for the parent because they think straight away that it makes them look bad, that a kid would think that's odd. But how do you approach that, or how would you?
I just answer the question. I've gotten a million of those questions, and I think the best way to answer it is to be honest about it. I mean, depending on the earshot, I've had questions asked about me by kids to their parents, like on public transport. Why did she paint her face brown? I've, you know, a little child asking their parent that question. And the parent was beautiful. They explained, no, darling, that's her skin color. Oh, everybody has different skin colors. She showed her daughter how different their skin was. You know, there were different shades. So people, depending on where you're from or what country, you know, where you were born, everybody has different skin color, hair color, eye color, and, you know, everybody's beautiful. And so just kind of taking the question as a legitimate question, answering it, and then kind of normalizing again.
Rather than being like, don't say that, because that doesn't help anyone.
Exactly. That just creates shame. It creates shame for anyone hearing it. So actually just honoring the question, because it is genuinely coming from quite an innocent place.
Yeah. And then my last question, Rana, is someone wrote in saying that they have very liberal, open, inclusive conversations at home, and then they go to a family function with the uncle or the grandparent, and that all turns to shit. They hear some things that they find either a bit triggering or just downright wrong to say. Okay. And I've actually witnessed this in the workplace. Disability is close to my heart and close to my family. If I hear the R word, it physically does something to me. It makes me feel unsafe and unhappy, and it makes me want to hate that person there and then. But I know that hate with hate doesn't work too. So what do people do in this situation where they're at odds with a family member or similar?
Such a good question, because I think this is a really live thing that's happening for families. We're doing the work, but then we live in an environment or a system that hasn't quite caught up yet. I think the best thing to do is, while we're doing that education with our children, is to also educate them about the fact that not everybody feels this way or thinks this way, so that they're prepared to, when they hear it, to fall back on, oh yeah, not everybody feels this way. And that's okay, but we have to help them understand, or we can actually support people to get to this place as well. My daughter has done it to me so many times around gender. You know, I have family members who probably aren't as feminist as I am, and she questions, you know, why is it always the women in our family doing the cleaning up or the cooking?
Wow.
The men don't. And that, you know, is really challenging for some of my family members. And so really explaining to her, just like everybody's different, everybody has different opinions, and that's okay. It's okay if someone disagrees with you as well.
Yeah, I think, that's really, you know, good advice. I've actually never heard that as an answer. That's really smart.
You know your child, but for my daughter, it was I'm really distressed because I've been taught one thing and these people are saying the opposite. So just really helping her understand that's what diversity is. Diversity is of opinion, and that's okay.
Rana, I could honestly just like speak to you 40 hours a week every single week, but unfortunately the world doesn't work that way. So let's leave everyone with where they can find you online.
Come and find me at Rana B. Hussein on Instagram, or you could go to Good Human Insta as well. But I'm very appreciative of DMs, I have to say. So
love it.
Free to
slide in. Slide on in.
Yeah, I'm also on LinkedIn, but, you know, Instagram's the best.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.